Okay. So it always says the challenge of giving a shiur on Tisha B'Av that one is not supposed to make it too much fun. So what the rabbi said is that one should teach the more depressing elements of rabbinic literature, biblical literature. The problem is that the rabbis were good writers, and so they tend to make even the most depressing elements fun. So in this section, which is supposed to be the most depressed, the section of tractate Gittin, which deals with the stories of the resurrection of the destruction of the temple, you have, among other things, the dance of the seven veils, groups of mass suicide, mass murder, and sort of all the elements that are really good action flicks. So we're gonna try and tell the story there is a dance of the seven veils here, believe it or not. We may not get to it. But it's in there. All the elements there, captive princesses, everything you can possibly want. A little bit of bathroom number two. Pretty much everything you can want in a story like this. Okay. But the origin of the beginning of this figure, the halakhic context of it is a discussion of how the rabbis should handle land ownership in the aftermath of the failure of the various rebellions against Rome, when much of the land in Israel has been redistributed on the basis of the power grab. How you deal with, on the one hand, if you refuse to recognize the transfers of ownership that have been made under duress, then nobody owns any of the land and you can't have any agriculture whatsoever. On the other hand, if you recognize those transfers, then you are permanently entrenching the effects of conflict and oppression. That's the halakhic context. There's a lot of work being done now in trying to connect rabbinic narrative with rabbinic law. And if you can figure out the connection, the really tight connection here, that would be great. The introduction to this section is a statement by Rabbi Yochanan, who is a first generation Palestinian Mora, in which he quotes the verse, and he says, "What does the following verse mean?" and never answers it. So the first mystery of this text is trying to figure out what does he mean? How does the verse he says relate to the narrative which follows? So the Mar of Yochanan, so the Yochanan said, "What's the meaning of the verse?" And he quotes the verse in Proverbs chapter 28. Fortunate is the man who is continually afraid, and the one who hardens his heart will fall into evil. Okay, he asks that question, never gets answered. So it's up to you to figure out where in the story, right, who in the story is the fortunate one who is always afraid, and who in the story is the one who hardens his heart who falls into evil. Okay, now the answer the Talmud apparently brings is that there are three different stories. Okay, three stories of how particular Jewish cities were brought to destruction on the basis of what seemed like a local narrative. The stories, respectively, of destruction of Yerushalayim, the city of Tur Malta, and the city of Beitar. Now, the last two, right, Tur Malta and Beitar, are destroyed, apparently, to read the Talmud, because people overreacted to an example of Roman oppression. Whereas it says that the story, the tomb also was destroyed because of the story about a chicken and about a rooster and a hen. And that apparently involves the case that there was a practice of giving a rooster and a hen, tying a rooster and a hen to the carriage of a married couple, of a just married couple. So as a symbol, they should procreate like chickens. But apparently the Romans came along at one point and stole the chicken, the rooster, and the hen, and the Jews attacked them. And that got back to Rome. They said, "Look, the Jews are rebelling," and that's how the whole city was destroyed. Then it says that the city of Beitar, which we understand is being destroyed at the end of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, was actually destroyed because of a particular bag of some kind of aromatic herb. And again, because there was a particular place, so they grew this aromatic herb, the Romans tried, and somebody had an attachment to a particular one, the Romans came and grabbed it, and that started a rebellion. So it seemed like the theme of these stories is that one should not overreact to minor acts of Roman oppression if the consequence of overreaction is complete destruction. But the first story, the one which is famous, which is the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, doesn't seem to have the same theme at all. So if you can find some connection between the three of them, that would be tremendously helpful. You could try and make the claim that all three of them are sort of on the model of, for want of a nail, the kingdom was lost, right? Because they all give you small stories which lead to much broader consequences. And the question is, why is the Talmud interested in telling you stories with this moral? What's the religious aspect of saying to one to the nail the kingdom of law? Okay, so we start off by telling us the story of Samson and Bar Samson, which leads to the destruction of Jerusalem. This is probably the most famous story, and it's interesting, reading it encyclopedically, probably mostly in the cinematography. Because the story which is told extremely visually, and there's one moment which only makes sense if you have a movie set in mind, where you have to watch the camera angle. And if you watch the camera angle in the story, then you understand how the story happens. So the story is that there is a person who loves Kamsa and who hates Bar Kamsa. Now, we don't know who Kamsa and Bar Kamsa are and whether their names are coincidences or not. Right, whether this is somebody who loves the father and hates the son, and the name Kamsa means locust. If you can find a way to fit that in, that would also be locust. If you can find a way to fit that in, that would also be terrific. So there's a person who never gets named, a halugav, an anonymous person, who loves Kamsa and hates Bar Kamsa. He makes some kind of meal and he tells his servant, "Veal, I feel like Kamsa. Come, bring me Kamsa." But a servant goes and brings him Bar Kamsa. Now, we don't know why the servant comes and brings him Bar Kamsa. It could be that the servant was hard of hearing, and, you know, and went to the French to a pirate instead of to a pilot. Or it could be that the servant really didn't like the master and didn't deliberately create trouble, or it could simply be an innocent mistake. So the servant comes and brings Bar Kamsa. So now the anonymous meal giver comes, and he sees Bar Kamsa, they're sitting on the way. He says to him, now here's an interesting thing is that the characters all talk like rabbits. And when he comes and he finds Bar Kamsa sitting there, you can feel the thumbs with him. And I can only meet him. Yes, Ahu Gabra, Dal Gabra Hava. My boy Safa. He says, what? This man there is the enemy of this man here. What's he doing here? Right, then all of a sudden, right after this long deliberative thing, he says in two wonderful words, "Kum po," get up and get out. So to which Bar Kamsa says, "Well, you know, look, now that I'm here, why don't you leave me alone and I'll pay you for my food?" And he says, "No." And he says, "Okay, I'll pay you half the cost of the entire meal." And he says, "No." He says, "Okay, I'll give you the cost of the entire meal." He says, "No." Not to the other, so then the honest host picks up Bar Kamsa in his hand, and picks him up to Akhe and throws him out. Okay, at which point Bar Kamsa suddenly develops the Talmudic sense. But here you have to have the camera angle. Because so far, all we've seen is, right, there's a meal, there's a servant, there's a host, and then the camera, when Bar Kamsa was brought to the meal, it's a very narrowly focused angle, so all you see is him sitting at a table, and the host comes and finds him. So all of a sudden, as he's being thrown out, the camera pans, and you see that there's a whole group of rabbis in the background. And they apparently were also invited to the meal. Now Bar Kamsa says, "Ha'il the Habayate Rabbanah Lomapuze, since the rabbis were sitting there and they didn't object, show me now, so I can drive from this, and it's loose. They must have liked it. Ezel, Ezel, those first of them all said, so I'm going to go denounce the entire Jewish people to Rome because the rabbis didn't object to my being thrown out." Now, what we don't know is whether the rabbis saw it or not. Right? This could all be a question of unfair inferences, or it could be that it's accurate because we weren't shown. And all we see, right, so far we've just been tightly focused on Bar Kamsa and the host. And it's only on the way out that you all of a sudden see that all the rabbis were there. But you have to make up your own mind whether you think the rabbis were there and noticed, or the rabbis were there and didn't notice, and then we have to figure out if we're going to blame the rabbis. Do we blame them for being there and noticing and not doing anything? Or do we blame them for simply being unconscious? Right? While they're at the meal of being aware of how some people are being treated. Okay. So he decides that because the rabbis are there and didn't object, so that implies the rabbis must like this happening to him, so he's going to go denounce them to the Romans. So he shows off in front of Caesar and he says, "Martin Buck, you die. The Jews are rebelling against you." So Caesar says, "How am I supposed to know that? probably 30 people a day came and said the Jews were rebelling against him. That was it. And that was pretty common news. It was usually true. But the Romans didn't really want to overreact to it. They spent time doing nothing but putting down the walls in Palestine. So he wants to know, how am I supposed to know this?
So he said to them, send them a sacrifice.
Let's go see if they bring the sacrifice. Because, in general, it seemed like a good warning, right? If presumably the deal was that if the Jews bring a sacrifice, that means they don't mind if their God loves you. Right? And when the Jews stop bringing sacrifices and you send, that means that they're trying to make sure their God is entirely on their side and they must be rebelling against you. So, if they send the sacrifice and see if they bring it. So he sends this fatted three-year-old calf, and while he's coming, he's a very clever man. He finds places in which he can blemish the animal in such a way that it's a blemish according to Jewish law, but it's not a blemish according to Roman law. But apparently the Romans don't know this is a blemish according to Jewish law, and not according to Roman law.
So then when he shows up and brings the sacrifice, the Jews, of course, immediately say, uh-oh, Caesar sending up a blemish sacrifice.
So there's a rabbinic debate. The rabbi says, they just want to bring it. The rabbis think, well, you know what? Maybe we should bring the sacrifice anyway, because we understand perfectly well that if we don't bring the sacrifice, Rome's going to come and crush us.
So the character named Rabbi Zacharias ben Apkulus gets up and says to them in apparent shock, but then people will say, but you can sacrifice animals to the blemishes. And this apparently shuts down the entire conversation. Everyone says, no one ever thought of that.
Which is really puzzling. Like, why? You know, of course everyone knew it, right? And the answer to that is pretty simple. We'll say, no. We brought this animal which has a blemish because we wanted to make Caesar happy. He could have told people that, and people probably would have understood that. So it's very hard to understand. Why it is that this claim,
people will say that blemished animals that were on the altar should shut down the conversation. So the rabbis having been convinced you can't, under any circumstances, allow people to come to the false conclusion that one can bring blemished animals on the altar, decided there's a simple solution, which is simply to kill the guy who brought the animal.
Right? That would be great. That would be fine. And but the part that's going after all, he is trying to get the entire Jewish state crushed because of
by reporting the Romans. So you know, there's a pretty good case for getting rid of him. So the part that's cool comes to the rescue again. They look at it and say, people are going to say that anybody who makes a blemish an animal dedicated to the temple will get killed.
And this, of course, would lead to a mass wave of murders all across the Jewish right, all across Israel. Once again, this completely stopped the conversation. And so they don't bring the animal, and they don't kill him, and he gets to go back to Rome and tell
the emperor, guess what? The Jews didn't bring a sacrifice. There it is. Right, and so the Romans are going to come and crush the Jews.
So Richard Yochanan says, Anavat Nusu, so Anavat Nusu is a term of deep lexical difficulty, I would say. You can treat it as sort of an intensified Anava. Now what Anava means is also complicated. I remember being sort of chastened the first time I discovered the Meek Shalom Herod Derek was in Kedon. Because the King James translates anav as meek and not humble. The terms meek and humble tend to have very, very different connotations in contemporary English. So anav natan would be an exceedingly meek person in King James English, and I'm not sure that humble is a really good term at all. So the anavat nusa of the fire of Nathulus, et Peitenu, destroyed our house, and burnt down our sanctuary. They come in there, and they build us from our land. So, the first question we ask is, so who is the fortunate person who is continually afraid? Well, anyone figure it out?
I'm happy to hear. That's a mystery that's bothered me for many, many years. The opening verse, the Yochanan said, right, fortunate is the person who is afraid continually.
If you can found anybody who was afraid continually and would have been better off being afraid continually in the story, that would be terrific.
Right, but he's not fortunate at all. He's the one who leads to the destruction of the temple. And it doesn't sound like the story which is about the fortune of being afraid. Okay. Secondly, is it really the story of Atulus' fault? It sounds like it's really the fault of the rabbis who don't object to the praise to Bar Kamsa being thrown out. Or is Bar Kamsa's fault for assuming the rabbis didn't object, and really they would have objected had they even known?
It's
before all the stories.
Well,
and so it could be later on, but I haven't found anything that answers it better.
That's better. That's better. You're claiming it just means be afraid. Right, be afraid, be very afraid. okay, next question.
Okay, maybe you should be afraid more about eating dessert.
I'm not sure if you're focused on narrow interests. The problem I have is, why does the Rebbe Atulus get blamed when he's just one man? Why does he shut down the conversation? Right, everyone else is there, right? What's the Rebbe Atulus being, right, there's nothing, he raises an argument, right? If somebody's supposed to play devil's advocate, right, you want, if somebody's going to say, let's kill him, you want somebody to get up and say, well, let's think about whether we should kill him, and you then just say, no, we should kill him, and you go on, right? At least you feel better, he feels better, everyone feels better, because you had a serious moral conversation about this in there. there was a version in Esa Rabba, and they put her in the Rebbe Atulus back in the story earlier. And they say he's a friend. There was Zakaria the Maskulis was also at the meal. And he thought about objecting and decided not to.
So they tracked with Zakaria the Maskulis, he's there all along. I don't know which version of the story is earlier. So there he didn't object, but here he objects.
So that's not clear, but it's really strange to use somebody as excessively humble who stands up against everybody and carries the day in a healthy conversation. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a very interesting depiction of somebody who's exceedingly humble when they completely carry the day against the whole conference. Yes. So is that what meekness is? Inaction? Okay. Indecisiveness, right? I agree that if it said that, I was much happier. I'm just not sure I can stick with it on a button. I don't know what word to mean that. People with personal account with inaction is the best word we have. I don't know. I agree with that. That puzzles me no end. There's a fair amount of schools that's known in one other place in rabbinic literature, and that is there's a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel about the proper means of disposing of leftovers on leftovers, the end of the leftovers on your table after Shabbat, in which Beit Shammai says that you dump the table, one of them says you dump the table, and one of them says you throw things back, you throw things out, and he has this compromise solution which is that you look away while throwing things backwards. How do you connect that?
I don't know. Now it happens that because of an interesting manuscript phenomenon, so the line, the humility of the Karnat of Tulis destroyed our house, is also attached to that halakhic position it is, and it's effect in Shabbat. Right? So you can make the claim that it's a position about
Nukhan Shabbat that destroyed our temple. That seems almost certainly to be a manuscript phenomenon, but whatever that just, it's just a scribal tip, whatever you see the names of the Karim and the Pool, you start writing down who destroyed our temple and burned our, okay. They say, look the other way, that's very good. Right? Karim is the one who likes to look away. Very good.
Very good, that's a nice connection. Okay. So now, right, now we're in the revolt, and the
previously unnamed Caesar sends Nero to attack Jerusalem. And Nero comes, and he engages in an act of augury or divination, whatever you want, before he attacks Jerusalem. He shoots an arrow into the air, and it falls in Jerusalem. And the problem is he shoots an arrow into the air in all four directions.
And all four arrows, no matter what, he stands outside the walls of Jerusalem, shoots arrows out the direction, they all land in Jerusalem.
So which he comes to the reasonable conclusion, I'll have to wait on the next. So he tried, after all 4 hours land in Jerusalem, so Nero also comes across a Jewish school child. And so one of the standard means of fortune telling, I guess, of the soothsaying was to stop the Jewish school child and ask them,
what verse are you learning in school today? And he derived something from the verse they're learning in school. For example, most famously, I think that people know, is when Elisha ben Avuya, Acher, right, is being encouraged to repent by Rabbi Meir, he stopped the school child and spoke to Ray, and they learned about all the verses about how some people never get to repent. So
Nero stops the school child and says, what did you learn today? Hopefully it's good promise, but there is good the sight to me your verse from today, and he says to them the verse from Ezekiel, which says, and I will place my revenge against Rome, which is how we would have said Edom, against Edom, which is Rome, in the hands of my nation, Israel. Now this is a really interesting verse.
Now you're about, right, you're a Roman general, you're about to attack Jerusalem, and the verse to me that is presented to you is,
and I will place my revenge against Rome in the hands of my people Israel. How do you understand that verse? So you're a Roman general, right? You're assuming this verse is teaching what? Revolution.
No, he's going to attack, and God will be to
So, okay, so he comes to the conclusion that this is a trap. Not a military trap, but a spiritual trap. Right? That Jerusalem is going to be destroyed anyway because God wants to destroy Jerusalem. But God is bringing Rome to destroy Jerusalem so that Rome can then be held liable for having destroyed it. Alright, so Nero says, right, Kusha briefly boil up the Rube Bese. God wants to destroy his house. He wants to sort of wash his hands with me. And say, no, it's not me, it's you.
Right, and then later God can destroy Rome and say, I'm just doing it for the sake of the Jews. So Nero goes and converts.
You may not have heard this in your history book, but
Nero joins the ranks of, great founders like Aristotle, and we'll see some other Roman emperors
convert in the course of this narrative. And he has a descendant, the descendant of Rabbi Meir, which plays a role in some of Rabbi Meir's statements later on, which Rabbi Meir
is seen as having Roman blood.
Okay. So with Nero out of the way, having around Nero, just have to leave the story at this point. The next person he gets sent is Vespasian. It's Vespasianus Caesar. So Vespasian comes to Houston, he launches a 3-year siege of Jerusalem.
And everything comes in threes, and there are three rich people in Jerusalem, Maximin ben Gurion, who then tells the Savua, and then Sisi Lakesit.
Okay, these are the three really rich people in Jerusalem, each of them has their own story. And Ephesian ben Gurion is the one who the sun stopped for one, because at one point he pledged that there was insufficient water for all the people coming to Jerusalem, and he found some rich guy and said, I will either give you,
let me use your 12 cisterns to feed the Jews coming to Jerusalem for the regular,
and if you do that, then I promise you they'll all be refilled by rain. And if they aren't refilled by rain, then I will give you the equivalent of 12 cisterns full of gold. And so the rich man gives them the cisterns, he feeds them, and there's no rain. And it's the last day,
and the rich guy keeps coming to him saying, where's the gold? Where's the gold? And he doesn't have the gold.
So he walks into the temple and he says, God, I didn't do this for myself, I didn't do this for my family, I just did it for you. So the people coming on pilgrimage would have water. And it poured.
It just pours.
And all the cisterns are full, and you think the story's over then. And he walks up happy, and he meets the other guy coming out. The other guy says, it's tough. It was already after sunset. Too late. And so he went to bring a bus, looks back into the temple, and says,
this is kind of a waste, but let's do it so the clouds won't break out and so the sun starts shining again. Even though it really was after dark.
Although, presumably, to make it honest, it started raining just before it got dark. We had no way of proving that because it was dark already, so that, right, so the sun went held off.
And it's all right. That's not the end of the story. There's also been called the Savua, who has sort of a unpleasant name. It's the son of the painted dog.
So apparently, if you left this house, you weren't hungry anymore. And it seems that kept it. It was somebody whose fringes used to either sit up among the Romans or before that he had servants running behind him carrying cushions to make sure that his feet never touched the ground. In any case, they had so much grain that they could have withstood a 21-year siege. And so the station should have been out there for another 18 years. But there are
these Diryone, who are usually translated as ruffians. We don't really know what that means. In one place, that seems to be in Surrey Ranier, it seems to be a sort of attendant substitution for heretics. But here it seems to mean like sort of the Young Turks.
The war party in Jerusalem. So they say to the rabbis, let's go and make peace. The Romans don't want to be out there for another 18 years. We don't want to be in here for another 18 years. Well, let's go make peace. But the ruffian, the war party says, no, we're not going to let you do that. So they send the rabbis, let's go fight them. And the rabbis say, no, that's not going to work. We have yet another of these total standoffs.
And doesn't sound so terrible because it's a standoff and the peace party should win.
And in a sense, at least we should just stay inside our 18 years being under siege. But the Diryone instead go and burn down all the granaries in Jerusalem. In a sense to force the Jews to fight. So Jerusalem really could have held out, the Rabbinic position in Jerusalem could have held out another 18 years. Maybe the Romans would have gotten bored, maybe would have made peace. But we burned down our own granaries to create the famine. So now a famine comes. Because even though they burn down the granaries, it doesn't work because the rabbis still won't let them fight. Right, so they just end up with the worst of all possible worlds. You can't withstand a siege. Right, you don't have the unity necessary to fight. You don't have the unity necessary to make peace. Then we get a sort of pet peeve, which is the story of Martha, the daughter of Boethius. So Martha
Baptistus was another part of the really rich people in Jerusalem. And so she sends,
in the midst of the famine, she sends her servant, and she says to him, go bring me the finest, I want a loaf of the finest flour. But servants don't seem to do so well in the story. So he goes and he says, well, guess what? They don't have grade A flour, they only have grade B flour.
But he comes back and he tells her, well, they don't have grade A flour, they have grade B flour. So he says, okay, go bring me grade B flour.
So he goes back to the market, and guess what? All the grade B flour is gone now. There's still a grade C flour. But does he think no? He comes back there and he says, there are a lot of grade B flour. But they got the grade C flour, so they go get the grade C flour. So she says, yeah, go get me the grade C flour. So he goes back to the market, and you can figure out for yourself what that is. They're all out of grade C flour.
Right, but if grade C flour, does he bring up? Nope, he doesn't buy the grade C flour.
He comes back and he says, okay, and he says, there's no grade C flour, there's a grade C flour. So, she gives up on him at this point. And she decides she's going out herself. But the point is, she's never been outside before.
So she puts on a pair of shoes. Actually, no, apparently she doesn't have her shoes on. She walked outside barefoot. And she walks outside barefoot and there's a piece of gum on the ground. And it touches her and she goes, ooh, and dies.
That's the end of the story. And this fulfills it. So the Yochanan Ben Zakkai
says, this is the verse, this is what we say to the verse in Eifa, right, the softest among you and the most used to pleasure,
whose legs had never been tested at all. Right, just to step on the land. Okay, that's just to tell you how the famine was going. But there's an even better story about the famine. Okay, the other story about this is
that there was a rabbi named Rabbi Sada,
They could have fasted for many, many years to try and prevent the destruction of Jerusalem. And so it turns out that afterwards, after Jerusalem is destroyed, one of the three things that Yochanan Zakkai asks for help is he wants people to heal before they set up. All they set up eight, where he would take these dry figs and he would get them really, really dry, and then he would cut on them. That's all he did for many, many years. So some people say that what happened is that she found one of the leftover figs that we cut up, and she choked on it. And that's how she died. That's how bad this happened to her. And I go, that's the 40 years. That's all Rabbi Sado had drunk. So as she was dying, she took all the gold and silver out of her house and threw it into the marketplace, saying, "Who needs this?" And that's what it was. The verse says, "In Ephesus, they will throw their silver into the footpath." Okay, we have a few more minutes. We'll just rapidly get to the highlights.
Yeah, that's the area of the story. Probably have to wait for next year for that. After they're all captured, so the end of the story is all about how really beautiful the Jewish captives are. And so the Romans
spend their life, the only way they can get an erotic stimulation is by keeping Jews around. Because they find themselves completely unsatisfying, so they tie the Jews up in the bedrooms and leave them there, and all sorts of things like that. And one of the stories is a story in the marketplace with a Jewish slave woman who is dressed in seven layers of covering, and somebody comes by and tries to buy her. And that's how you get married. So the covering will get removed gradually. Any case, actually, this is probably a really good point to stop. So that's next year.
We'll get to the rest of the story. Thank you for listening.